From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how war with Iraq could reshape the politics and economics of oil. We talk with economist Daniel Yergin. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. Also, some behind-the-scenes stories from the authors of Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. We talk with Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is asking the federal courts to bring an end to a 10-day lockout of dock workers at 29 ports on the West Coast. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
This is the first time in 24 years a president has invoked the Taft-Hartley Act. The reason, according to the president, is the negative impact the labor dispute is having on the economy. He says jobs are being lost in manufacturing plants because of parts shortages and in the farm economy.
Americans are working hard every day to bring our economy back from recession. This nation simply cannot afford to have hundreds of billions of dollars a year in potential manufacturing and agricultural trade sitting idle.
The president's calling for an 80-day cooling-off period during which the port operators would be forced to reopen the ports. Unions are angry about the administration's decision to intervene. They say this disrupts the bargaining process and tips the balance in favor of management. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon expressed regret today for civilian casualties during an Israeli raid in the Gaza Strip, but he said the raid was a success in Israel's effort to root out Palestinian militants. The raid left at least 14 Palestinians dead and more than 80 wounded. Palestinians say most of those were civilians. The Israeli army says most were armed men. Sharon said there will be more operations in the Gaza Strip. Israel sent troops into the West Bank city of Hebron today after Palestinians fired into one of the city's three Jewish enclaves. About 450 Jewish settlers live in fortified areas of the city, which has 130,000 Palestinians. Secretary of State Colin Powell urged Congress to pass a resolution authorizing military action against Iraq. Powell said the president needs the resolution now. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Powell said that President Bush needs a strong showing of American unity as the United States is trying to garner international support for possible military action. The Bush administration would like to have a congressional resolution before the UN Security Council acts on a new resolution of its own. The U.S. is trying to convince the Council to approve tough new language to force Iraq's compliance with UN mandates. France and Russia, however, object to including an automatic trigger for the use of force if Iraq again defies the United Nations. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Investigators in the Washington, D.C. area are searching for clues to the identity of the sniper who's killed six people and wounded two others in less than a week. Police say they've received more than 7,000 calls with possible leads. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 78 points, just over 1%, to close at 7,501 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained nearly 10 points to close at 1129. This is NPR News. A new private survey says the Jewish population in the U.S. has declined and aged in the last 10 years. It also found that American Jews are not having enough children to keep their numbers stable. NPR's Duncan Moon reports.
The National Jewish Population Survey found that 5.2 million Jews live in the United States, down 300,000 from 1990. The median age rose from 37 to 41, fueling concern that the faith is not being passed down effectively to the younger generation. The study also found that half of Jewish women aged 30 to 34 have no children. By comparison, only 27% of all American women in the same age group are childless. The multimillion-dollar survey is among the most influential calculations of Jewish demographic developments in the U.S. It has been credited with sparking social changes as American Jewish communities seek to reverse the downward trends. The second half of the study, due in November, will present figures on intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews. Duncan Moon, NPR News, Washington.
A federal magistrate in Buffalo, New York, has granted bail to only one of the six men accused of belonging to an al-Qaeda terror cell. The magistrate allowed Sahim Alwan to post a $600,000 bond, saying that Alwan had disavowed any continued activity in al-Qaeda. He will remain under house arrest. Prosecutors have said that the men attended an al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan between April and June of 2001. They're charged with providing material support to a foreign terrorist organization. All six men have denied being members of al-Qaeda. They're not charged in connection with the September 11th attacks. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Rational, the software development company, providing integrated lifecycle tools, software engineering practices, and services. On the web at rational.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night, President Bush presented his case for going to war with Iraq if Saddam Hussein refuses to disarm. Iraq has something we don't want it to have, weapons of mass destruction. But it also has something that is very valuable, oil. And war with Iraq could change the economics and politics of oil for a long time to come. My guest Daniel Yergin won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1991 book about the history of oil, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. Yergin co-wrote the book Commanding Heights about the global economy and the economic history of the 20th century. He also co-produced the PBS adaptation, which is now out on video and DVD. Yergin is chair of Cambridge Energy Research Associates. I asked him how much oil Iraq is sitting on.
If you look at what's in the ground, what's called proven reserves, Iraq is actually the second largest. The only country with larger proven reserves at this point happens to be its neighbor, Saudi Arabia. And there's long been a view, because Iraq has been kind of in an isolation booth, not just for 10 years, but for 20 years or more, that in fact those reserves could be larger and that Iraq could be an even more major source of oil. But the ironic thing is that Iraq has, over the last, particularly last year, but over the last several years, has really marginalized itself as an oil player. And just kind of two sets of numbers. When Iraq took the world by surprise and invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, suddenly overnight the world needed to replace 5 million barrels a day of Iraqi and Kuwaiti exports. Today, Iraq's exports are down around 1 million barrels a day, because it's been fighting with the United Nations over the oil for food program. It has periodically declared its own embargoes and cut off its supplies, and it's put extra charges on it, on price, that have caused people to flee. So Iraq, ironically, is not a huge exporter today, and that means that if there are hostilities and they don't spread to neighboring countries, there's enough capacity elsewhere to more than make up for Iraqi supplies.
So if Iraq is under attack and no oil is being pumped from there, that won't affect supplies.
But what you'd certainly see, you know, some of that is already, by the way, in the oil price. There's a kind of a fear premium. You know, if the price is around $30, $3, $4 of that price reflects anxiety about what's going to happen. And probably if hostilities start, that price goes up further, until the market sort of looks around and says, oh, well, there's other supplies, this is okay, and then the price comes down, which is really what happened, you know, the day the war began in 1991 to eject Iraq from Kuwait. The price, instead of going up, went down.
For people who suspect that oil has something to do with our plans in Iraq, they often suspect that even more because President Bush, President Bush's father, and Vice President Dick Cheney are all from oil business backgrounds. Do you think that might figure into it at all?
Well, it certainly, you know, you hear that all the time, and I think it's clear that they know the business. But I think there's this view of a monolithic oil business, and one of the things you get if you read the prize is you realize there's so many different elements of it, often competing. Vice President Cheney ran an oil services and construction company, a large one for about 4 years, but essentially what he is been a professional politician, a public servant. President George W. Bush, you know, it's often said he's comes from big oil, but actually the truth of it is he came from little oil. He had was involved with a small oil company, he more or less failed at that business, and, you know, he proved to be a success, actually, during the years he spent in the baseball business. So I don't think that these people are sitting there thinking somehow this is 1927 or 1954 and, you know, we're doing all of this for big oil. I think the other thing to note is that a lot of big oil is no longer American. Four out of seven of the major oil companies in the world are actually European, not American.
I think a lot of countries are trying to figure out what to bet on. Should they bet that Saddam Hussein is going to stay in power and therefore try to be on his side so that they could get oil benefits? Or should they bet that he's going to be overthrown? Let's look specifically at a couple of countries like Russia and France, which have contracts with Iraq now. Tell us a little bit about what those contracts are.
Right. France, over the years, have been closer to Iraq than many other European Western countries, and has, you know, done a, over the years, has done a lot of business with Iraq. And the French national, well, it's no longer national, there's a French super major, as it's called, that reflected a merger of the two companies, has these contracts to develop two very large oil fields in Iraq. And one of the things you have to understand that there are these huge oil fields that have just been sitting there since 1970. They haven't been developed or very marginally developed. But the French government has never signed off on the treaty because of the UN sanctions. So the company is sitting there with these two contracts that are not, that are kind of in principle, that have been initialed, but are not actually in effect, and they're not doing any work there. And they would only do work when UN sanctions are raised one way or another. So the French are, they have a preferred position, you might say, but it's not in effect, and they're not spending money, they're not drilling for oil, they're not shipping oil out of the country. So the French seem to be very keen. I mean, what's sort of very central for them is that whatever happens is done through a UN framework, through the framework of the Security Council, where they're a permanent member. But the French are, you know, they're kind of one of the great swing countries here in terms of which way do they go? Do they support a UN resolution? Of course, and part of the game right now is what kind of UN resolution comes out of this. But, they may be thinking that as long as Saddam is there, they're going to have these contracts in principle and never be able to do anything with them.
On the other hand, if Saddam Hussein is overthrown, will their contracts with Iraq be honored?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's where a lot of kind of action is right now, is, what's going to happen? Of course, Terry, let's stop and visualize for a second and say that there is a regime change and a new regime comes in. Well, the first problem that regime's going to have is kind of establishing its legitimacy, establishing its control. You know, it's not the same situation of Afghanistan, but, you know, that's not going to happen overnight. Then it says, okay, we have, unlike Afghanistan, which has precious little to sell into the world economy except, you know, drugs and things like that, we can earn a living. We can make $40, $50 million a day selling oil. So this is our precious resource. They're going to be pretty nationalistic, and they're going to say, you know, I don't think there are going to be any sweetheart deals, any favoritism. They're going to drive the kind of tough bargain that represents the sort of state of the the exploration business, what are the nature of the deals that people make, and, you know, they're going to get 85 or 90% of the revenues. But that probably takes maybe a year to sort out the politics, to work out the arrangements. Then it takes a couple of years to restore the Iraqi oil industry to where it was before it can really get on an expansion course. So that's the kind of process of negotiation. Then, you know, the companies that have positions there, like the French and the Russian and the others, will say, well, our deal really wasn't with Saddam Hussein or his regime. Our deal was with the sovereign state of Iraq. So we have a preferred position here, and our position should be reserved. The new government will probably say, you know, maybe yes, maybe no, and negotiate with them. I mean, I think I think the key question for Iraq is whether it is a stable political system with a new regime, because Iraq needs a lot of investment in its oil industry. It's really been deteriorating under Saddam, and its key thing, its capacity, has declined by something like 20 or 25% in the last 10 years, its ability to produce. So it needs a lot of investment, but it's not going to get investment from international companies unless they figure there's going to be stability of contracts, stability of government, that, you know, that things aren't going to become chaotic. So I think if Iraq gets to a relatively democratic, well-grounded political system, that probably means that more investment will come into the country faster and that Iraq will become a bigger producer and a bigger exporter sooner.
Let's look at Russia. Iraq owes Russia $8 billion in debt, and this is money that they have owed Russia since before the Gulf War. Russia's very worried about getting the $8 billion yeah. back. What kind of deals does Russia have with Iraq?
The Russians, as you say, are owed about $8 billion by the Iraqi regime. They're not getting paid. They don't know when or if they'll get paid. Iraq altogether, I think, owes something like $140 billion. So there are a lot of people in line to get paid there who are not getting paid. Russia has operated in Iraq, and Russian equipment is used there. There's been a relationship between the old Soviet oil industry and the Iraqi industry. Russian so-called oil service companies, which provide technology, are active there. And then you have these kind of $40 billion deals, you know, that are sort of announced. But, you know, whenever you hear people announce $40 billion deals, you know, there's a lot of air in there. And it's very vague as to what's there or not there. But so that's on the column of Russia being concerned about its present position. It, too, has companies that have significant contracts, also which are not being implemented because of U.N. sanctions.
My guest is Daniel Yergin, author of the book The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Iraq and oil. My guest is Daniel Yergin, author of Commanding Heights and the Pulitzer Prize-winning book about oil, The Prize. Well, talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia and what's what the Saudis see as in their best interest. Now, by the Saudis, I guess I mean the Saudi family.
Right. I think the Saudis are, are very concerned about hostilities and conflict in the region and what might follow from that. That's one set of concerns. They've not exactly been jumping up and down saying, you know, they want to get on this team. They've been standing off from it, reflecting their assessment of what's happening in their own public opinion and politics and so forth. I think they're also have gotten accustomed to Iraq being kind of this sort of rather minor, in relative terms, maverick in the oil business, and don't really know what it would be like if Iraq suddenly, over a period of a few years, became a major player. But between being a major player and being on the same level of Saudi Arabia is still a pretty big gap. But it would change the balance within OPEC, and it would change the balance in the region.
With the political problems that we're having in the Gulf area and with the terrorist threat that we face since September 11th, it seems the Bush administration has become even more interested in cultivating oil from other parts of the world. And those other parts include Russia, Central Asia, Africa. Let's look at Russia for a second. What's happening there with oil cultivation and how is that affecting our relationship with Russia?
There is a very dramatic turnaround going on now between United States and Russia. There was a large U.S.-Russian oil and gas summit that was held in Houston last week, which showed that things are happening, but there's still a lot of things to be worked out because you know, the Russian, one of the really interesting features is you're seeing these kind of emergence of these Russian Rockefellers, these Russian oil companies that are saying, well, we don't really necessarily need a lot of investment. And so there's a lot of discussion about what is and isn't possible. But one of the things that has hit me is that the Russians have decided that if they're going to be a real force in the world oil market, that Russia needs to be a significant oil exporter to the United States. And a year ago, I would have thought that's not very likely or practical. But today, I think it's, you know, there's a fair chance that a few years from now, we'll be importing some important part of our oil from Russia. And there was this, you know, a tanker of Russian oil arrived in Houston on July 4th. And the latest purchase of oil going into our Strategic Petroleum Reserve is coming from Russia. So that's pretty strong symbolism. And, you know, and what does it symbolize? It symbolizes diversification, less reliance on the Middle East, and that Russia will be playing a bigger role than one might have thought even a few years ago.
Now, former Soviet republics in Central Asia, like Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, are sources of oil. But to get them, pipelines would be needed to be created through Central Asia. So what are some of the politics now surrounding Central Asia and getting the oil out of there? And what kind of new political alliances are we trying to create to make those pipelines possible?
Yes. You're right. Central Asia is a real kind of hotspot. And this is, you know, the past and the future come together. One of the things when I was writing the prize that I was most amazed to discover is that at the beginning of the 20th century, the world's largest source of oil for a few years was none other than Baku in Azerbaijan. And here we are again. I think there were kind of exaggerated views that these countries were a new Middle East. And to the best of current knowledge, they're not. But they're significant new sources of oil. But you point to a very essential fact that this oil is basically landlocked. You can't just bring up a supertanker and fill her up and sail off. And so pipelines and pipeline politics have been on the table now for 6 or 7 years.
I think the United States is hoping that Africa will become an increasingly good source of oil for the United States. What are some of the countries we're looking at there now, hoping to cultivate for oil?
Well, the countries, of course, Nigeria is already a major producer and exporter of oil, and indeed a member of OPEC. But Angola is a very large source of oil, Equatorial, Guinea, and there are several other countries that basically that sort of area of West Africa is considered very prolific, and it too is a real hotspot. And, you know, a lot of activity is going on there. And if you think about, you know, it's sort of, you have to sometimes stand back and look at it. Right now, for instance, one of the major sources of oil in the world today is the North Sea between Britain and Norway. And realizing that West Africa will soon exceed the North Sea as a source. And that means, you know, very significant revenues flowing into those countries.
Now, you've pointed out that getting oil from Africa is fairly logistically easy, but it's very politically complex.
Yes, that everywhere you look in the world, there are these trade-offs. In case of Africa, you can load a tanker offshore, and you don't have to worry about building 2,000-mile pipelines or 1,500-mile pipelines. But you do have to worry, of course, that so many of these countries suffer from great poverty. They suffer from civil war, ethnic conflict, disease, kind of instability in their governments. And of course, corruption's a big issue right through the region. So those are kind of the obstacles to development. And then there's a kind of technical question, is that a lot of gas gets produced with this oil, and if you can harness that gas and create a kind of regional pipeline network, you could do a lot to create opportunities for people to raise their standard of living. So there the obstacles are not geological or technical, but they're really political and social.
Now, a French oil tanker was blown up in Yemen. It's unclear yet whether this was a terrorist attack or an accident. If it proves to be a terrorist attack, what significance do you think that would have?
If it proves to be a terrorist attack, then I think it would kind of affect the tilt of France and bolster French support for a UN resolution and, you know, dealing with Iraq, as well as French support in the war on terror. It would be one of those things that would push French politics in one direction rather than another. Because, of course, as you know, in France, there's been this huge bestseller, this 250,000 copies of this book sold, that says that September 11th was all carried out and by the U.S. government. I mean, really sort of paranoid conspiracy theories. So that would be a jolt to those. It's amazing, 250,000 people buying a book like that.
If there is chaos in the Gulf, do you think that we're best off diversifying our sources of oil, or do you think there's one particular country that we should really go for?
You know, there is no great solution. These issues of energy security, we've lived with them for almost 30 years. We've lived with them actually much longer when you think back to the Second World War. So I think that, you know, the first principle is diversification, because that enables you to absorb shocks and have alternatives. And, you know, if there was chaos in the Gulf, you're talking about a, you know, if you have a really nightmare scenario, that has huge implications.
Daniel Yergin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Yergin is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. His PBS series, Commanding Heights, An Economic History of the 20th Century, is now out on video and DVD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Audi and the all-new A4 Cabriolet. Open up your world. Information at AudiUSA.com. And by Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Columbus in the Americas by author William Least Heat Moon, now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the authors of the new book, Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. We talk with Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hey, let me say hi to Saddam.
Okay, hold on a second. Saddam, are you still there?
Who is that? One of your Jewish friends?
No. Well, yes. So.
Hey, Saddam.
Monica, you never call me anymore. Monica, oh, thanks for the beret. I love it. I love it.
Everyone is fair game for satire on Saturday Night Live. The show, which began as a late-night experiment in 1975, is now a TV institution. My guests Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller have written a new book called Live from New York, an uncensored history of Saturday Night Live, as told by its stars, writers, and guests. Shales won a Pulitzer Prize for his TV criticism in The Washington Post. He's also reviewed movies for NPR's Morning Edition. Miller has written for TV and movies and is the author of a book about the Senate. Miller and Shales both think the funniest cast was the original one, Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Jane Curtin, Garrett Morris, Lorraine Newman, and Gilda Radner. Here's some of their work.
Yes?
Mrs. Arlsberg?
Who?
Mrs. Barlinger.
Who is it?
Flowers.
Flowers for whom?
Plumber, ma'am.
I don't need a plumber. You're that clever shark, aren't you?
Candy Graham.
I just think that, well, you should from now on try to do your best, okay?
Oh, yes, dear, and I'm very, very sorry, and I promise from now on I will do my best.
See that you do.
Bitch.
I'm gonna get me a shotgun and kill all the whiteys I see.
Eggs, couple of eggs, couple of eggs, and over lightly with sausage, café, café.
No eggs.
When do you stop serving breakfast?
No, no breakfast.
No breakfast?
Nope.
Fine, I just want a couple of eggs.
No breakfast, cheeseburger, huh?
I don't want a cheeseburger.
Come on, don't give me that. Come on, let's go. We gotta have turnover. We want a cheeseburger? Come on, everybody get a cheeseburger. You want a cheeseburger? Come on, cheeseburger.
I don't want a cheeseburger. It's too early for a cheeseburger.
Too early for a cheeseburger? Look, cheeseburger.
The impression I get from your book is that of all the performers on Saturday Night Live, particularly the ones from the early years, that Chevy Chase was the least popular, and that he particularly didn't get along with John Belushi. So what was it that made Chevy Chase so unanimously unpopular?
Well, in John's case, though, it was a reversal of roles, because in the National Lampoon stage show, John was the star and dominant, and indeed he's electrifying in person, and Chevy was a supporting player, more or less. But when you switch it around to television, Chevy was a far more telegenic performer. And if Marshall McLuhan was right, that it's a cool medium, then it makes sense that Chevy, who's a much cooler personality, would come through much better on TV, whereas Belushi, who's a very hot, explosive personality, you know, might not. It took a lot of exposure to John Belushi before people got used to him. And in fact, he would have to lampoon his own kind of explosiveness when he would do those hilarious commentaries on the news, twirling himself around into a fury, and then he'd sort of fly into the air and disappear behind the desk. But, you know, if there was an animosity between John and Chevy, it's not all Chevy's fault. But Chevy does have a naturally kind of abrasive, irritating personality. Would you say irritating or just...
Yes, I think in the first season, particularly because he broke out as a star and they didn't, there, you know, you had the jealousy factor right away. And then, you know, by Chevy's own admission, he did have a hard time dealing with stardom, including some difficulties with drugs. And I think that manifests itself in rather mean ways towards people.
He has a knack Chevy has this strange knack for saying the first thing that pops into his head, no matter how mean it is. And I've seen him, you know, we had many more examples of this than we even put in the book. And I guess Chevy's feeling that we picked on him, but we didn't. We just reported what people said. I mean, I've been in a room with him when someone brought in some iced tea for him and accidentally spilled a little on the rug. And Chevy just became just virulently abusive to this kid, one of the aides, you know, whatever they call him, a production assistant. And the kid was trembling. And I thought, well, why does Chevy, a big star, have to yell at this kid and make him miserable? It's something is wrong with his personality. And whatever his talents are, and they're immense, he has this thing to overcome. He's rubbed a million people the wrong way.
You write a little bit about some of the conflicts and tensions in the early days of Saturday Night Live between the male and the female performers. Lorraine Newman says, the boys got away with a lot. They were bad and we were good. We were punctual, they were late. We were clean, they were dirty. We were prepared and they weren't. Then a couple of people talk about how John Belushi wouldn't be in sketches written by women.
In fact, one of the things that Lorne used to do was he used to either use a male writer's name or just keep a female writer's name off the sketch if he wanted John to do it. John had some very peculiar ideas, first of all, about television. His wife, Judy Belushi, told us about the fact that their television at home was covered with spit because he would love to spit at the TV. He really had to be convinced to do Saturday Night Live by a lot of people because he thought television was an inferior art. Couple that with the fact that he was not misogynistic, but he really felt like, as Rosie Schuster said to me, who was one of the writers on Saturday Night Live, he didn't really believe that women could be funny. And so he had a hard time with the idea of a woman writing a sketch for him.
What impact do you think John Belushi's death from an overdose had on the people who started Saturday Night Live with him?
One effect it had upon them was they all stopped doing drugs, at least for a few minutes, and some of them even stopped doing smoking pot, I think, which, you know, pot around the Saturday Night Live offices on the 17th floor was like Coca-Cola around a normal office. I remember Lorne showing me through once, and we opened the door to Tom Davis and Al Franken's office, and then this cloud of smoke rolled out like, you know, fog over San Francisco Bay. It was marijuana smoke. And so after John's death, I think, though, they suddenly became aware that there could be dire consequences to all this recreational drug use.
Although it should be pointed out that, as Carrie Fisher says, the very first question that a lot of them asked was, what was he doing? Because they were worried about, you know, he was doing something that they were doing. It turned out that they weren't freebasing heroin, so their first initial reaction was, well, that's okay, because we're not doing that.
Right. Well, their first reaction was they were sad that John was dead.
Right.
Again, and let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Their second reaction was, oh, thank God, I wasn't doing the drug that he was doing.
One thing that seems consistent through the years on Saturday Night Live is that there's always one or two people who are telling you about how they'd go home at night and just cry because it was so frustrating. Either nothing was being written for them or what they were writing wasn't getting on or they felt that things were too competitive and they weren't looking good. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Lorne has always operated a competitive ship, and actually the Washington Post, where I work, is much the same. Lorne and Ben Bradley, as a matter of fact, have a lot of similarities. I never thought of that before. But the competitiveness is built into it, and people who can't take it do sort of fall by the wayside.
It is not a nurturing environment. If you are a person that craves feedback, you're at the wrong place.
And Lorne is notorious for withholding praise. Whether he does this as part of a strategy, whether it's just part of his natural sort of shyness and standoffishness, I don't know. But he is not the easiest person in the world to work for. On the other hand, he can be very caring and attentive to people and their problems. And this has endeared him to many of those who work there now and many of those who worked there in the past. And even people he's fired in the book say nice things about him. Yeah, sure, he fired me, but I still admire him. I find that quite amazing. I find Lorne quite amazing.
One of my favorite things that Conan O'Brien said was that when he was a writer on the show, he would be walking down the hall and Lorne would pass him and just look at him and say, "Still with the show, Conan?" You know, it's that kind of environment.
My guests are Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller, authors of the new book Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the history of Saturday Night Live with Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller, authors of a new oral history of the show called Live from New York. Saturday Night Live has always been famous for political sketches and for political impressions, you know, impressions of presidents and first ladies and congressmen, senators. And I think that became particularly true during the Bush-Gore presidential race. Saturday Night Live became very famous for the impressions in that. I'm wondering if you got any insights about what was happening politically behind the scenes in that era, and whether there was a lot of political agreement or disagreement on the part of the writers and the performers about how Bush and Gore should be portrayed. Can you talk about that a little, what happened behind the scenes politically?
I think it's never been a question of orthodoxies. I think that one of the things that turns the writers and Lorne on about these political creatures is their behavior and the kind of image that we have of them. So when Al Gore kind of starts huffing and puffing, going like this when W is talking during debate, you know, he kept on doing that during the first debate.
Sighing.
They went to town on that, and they went to town so much that the Gore campaign wound up showing that to Gore the weekend after the sketch had appeared, to show him that he shouldn't sigh so much in the next debate. Those are the kind of things that turn them on. I think that they get the kind of, they tap into the zeitgeist by really kind of coming up with what the American people really think about the president or the candidate, and then they go to town with that. You know, when Will Ferrell was doing W in the 2000 election, I mean, Ralph Nader himself told us it was something you just had to watch because it was another way of understanding these people, and the writers and the performers really got off on that. Sometimes they're so far ahead of the curve, it's amazing. I remember Phil Hartman did a sketch as Bill Clinton right when Clinton was, you know, first on the national scene, and he was jogging and he stopped into a McDonald's and started eating everybody's hamburgers and drinking their shakes. And one of the Secret Service men said, "Well, Mr. President, we just won't tell the First Lady that, you know, you had this shake." And Clinton looked at him, or Phil Hartman in this case, and said, "Son, there's a lot of things we won't be telling Mrs. Clinton." And it was just, I mean, it was so great. And it was obviously years and years before Lewinsky and or anything like that. But they just tap into something that, you know, sticks with the culture.
Saturday Night Live has had its ups and downs over the years. What do you consider the worst year or the worst cast?
I think that there was probably, in my opinion, I guess there were two. One was the cast that started in 1980 when Gene Demanian took over after Lorne and the original cast had left. And that was when she was going to build the show around Charlie Rocket, which that was...
the rocket that never launched.
The rocket that never launched. And then in 1985, Lorne's first year back, he had decided to take a page from Dick Ebersol, who the year before had, rather than pick unknowns, he had put together like Billy Crystal and Marty Short and Chris Guest. That was a fantastic year. But the next year, 1985, Lorne picked a bunch of people who really weren't ready for Saturday Night Live, even though they had done other movies. And Michael Hall was in that, and Randy Quaid. And
it was a weird grab bag. And Al Franken told us one of the problems was you couldn't do a Senate sketch. You couldn't do a presidential political sketch because there were nobody to play those parts. They were just either these untried kids, including Robert Downey Jr., who tried many things as the years would go by, Or else Randy Quaid, who stuck out like the proverbial sore thumb. It was a weird group. Now, I would completely agree with Jim on which those were the two worst casts.
It's funny because Robert Downey Jr. And Randy Quaid are both really good actors, although they didn't work on Saturday Night Live very well.
Well, that's part of the legacy of Saturday Night Live as well, because look at Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is incredibly talented and kept us laughing for 10 years on Seinfeld. She was on Saturday Night Live and, you know, really was like a Porsche going 40 miles an hour. She never, ever really got to do anything that showed her talents. And anybody looking at her during her time there would have thought, you know, well, this is just somebody who's really not going to make it. Luckily, Larry David, who created Seinfeld, was one of the writers at that time, and he saw something in her that, you know, you really couldn't see from the sketches. Sometimes Saturday Night Live is not the best vehicle for figuring out whether somebody's truly talented.
But, you know, remember Bill Murray, it took months for Bill Murray to finally put himself over on the air. And one way he had to do it was to sit down and talk into the camera and say, "My name is Bill Murray. I'm not really making it on the show. I don't quite understand why." And he had this little dialogue with viewers, and it worked. And then suddenly his kind of character was something new, and people began to see what was funny about it. And today, I would say the most imitated performer in the history of Saturday Night Live, and I may be wrong, is Bill Murray. You can still see on ESPN, in commercials, on other sitcoms, there's always a guy trying to be that kind of hip, disconnected, irreverent, super cool guy that Bill Murray played way back when. He was the prototype. I think he invented a new comic character, and it's become just part of American folklore.
One of the more bizarre moments on Saturday Night Live was a few years ago when the singer Sinead O'Connor, after doing a song, held up a photo of the Pope, or a picture of the Pope, and then tore it to shreds in front of the camera. Something I understand was not rehearsed. What was that about? What happened behind the scenes afterwards?
Well, the first thing that happened was Dave Wilson, who was the director, made sure that they didn't push the applause sign. So there was dead silence in Studio 8H. It was a terrifying moment for a lot of people there because it was so unexpected. She had not told anyone, and not even Lauren. I mean, no one expected it. And she had just done the dress rehearsal about an hour before, and, you know, everything was fine. And then she said between dress and air that she was going to show something at the end of her song, and so she wanted the director to be aware of that so they would get the close-up.
I think she specified a picture of a hungry child or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And they even had one at dress rehearsal. They had a picture of a hungry child.
But no one knew what she was going to do. So the media reaction was just, you know, nobody could believe it happened. The great thing about Lauren, though, afterwards, instead of being really ticked, he said, "Well, I was awfully courageous of her." And he just somehow he saw the, you know, her gumption. And
he admired the gesture, but he did not admire being tricked or being lied to. That made him mad. And they had set it up so methodically where they said, "Now, can you just have it one camera on her, not, you know, don't have any other cameras to switch to?" So they were trapped with one shot of Sinead O'Connor. The only thing they could have gone to would have been a reaction shot of the audience, which would have been worse, I suppose, at that point when she tore up the picture. So Lorne may have admired the gesture in a philosophical way, but they were just furious that she would lie to them and trick them. And I don't think she's ever been invited back. In fact, her career didn't exactly skyrocket after that.
My guests are Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller, authors of the new book Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Oh,
We're talking about the history of Saturday Night Live with Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller, authors of a new oral history of the show called Live from New York. I bet one of the things you asked a lot of people from Saturday Night Live was to share their nightmare moments, the moment that was just like the worst moment of their career on Saturday Night Live. Can you tell us about a couple of the nightmare moments?
Actually, a lot of the nightmare moments on the show wind up happening behind the scenes. I think that when you get to the sketch stage of the show, when you're live at 11:30, things are pretty well nailed down.
Lorne doesn't like ad-libbing, and he doesn't like breaking up over a sketch, and he thinks it looks phony. And so when that happens, I think he sometimes chastises people. But on the other hand, sometimes it's so good-natured and inescapable. You know, Brendan Fraser was on, and his wig fell off and drooped down over his head, and somehow they all got the giggles, and the audience began to laugh. The audience likes being there when something goes wrong because they think they're privy to this secret information, which, of course, is going out to 14 million homes. But anyway, it seems like something. You know, these days, if you watch Saturday Night Live, you may see that show, you may see the show that way that time only. It may never again be repeated in that form because if something does go wrong, Lorne now has the option. They tape every dress rehearsal, so he has the option of pulling the sketch out of dress rehearsal and plopping it into the space where it was in the live show. He can re-edit shows for when they're rerun later. And so Saturday Night Live is still an event in the sense that this could be the only time the show was performed exactly that way, complete with those mistakes. I remember once they did, this sounds so trivial, and it is, but they did a sketch with that horrible Tom Green, who brought his own writers, and nobody liked him. But anyway, they had a little baby pig in this sketch, and the pig squealed and squealed and squealed and seemed so unhappy and miserable. And I was at home, and I was furious, thinking, you know, it's not funny to torture any animal, even a pig. And Lorne had an angry letter from some girl, a little girl in the audience, posted outside his office for weeks after that. Well, anyway, that was never seen again, because they simply threw that out and picked up the same sketch from the dress rehearsal where the pig was not in distress and plopped that into the space where it had been. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Did they ever rerun the show with Sinead O'Connor? And what did they do with that?
They rerun it all right, but they put the dress rehearsal performance in.
Huh.
So never again will you see her, except in a news program, in news footage, never will you see in a Saturday Night Live her tearing up a picture of the Pope.
Tom Shales, you've been a TV critic for The Washington Post for many years. I imagine you've written a lot about Saturday Night Live over the years, some good things and some bad things. Did you actually interview people for this book who you'd given bad reviews to over the years, who maybe didn't really want to talk to you?
Just Chevy. I was afraid of Chevy, partly for that reason. And Chevy and I, we go way, way back, because the first season, Saturday Night Live, you know, skyrocketed into the public consciousness. They all came to Washington to be part of some White House correspondence dinner. You know, we have 800 dinners here every year. And so Lorne invited me to spend the day with them. So I followed them around, Lorne and Chevy and John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, and they were wonderful. They made up bits wherever we were. They would do improvisations just for each other, and I got to enjoy them. And then after a few hours, I heard Chevy say to Lorne, loudly enough so that I could hear it, "Is this guy going to be with us all the time? About me?" And I thought, well, gee, how rude. And Lorne said, you know, "Shut up, Chevy," or something like that. And then years later, I reviewed Chevy's first special after he left the show. He got a deal to do specials for NBC, and he invited me to come with him to Glen Sound in L.A. I don't know why I was in L.A., to mix the sound. And he sat there being very cocky at the console, telling the engineer to, you know, punch up the laughter. Give us a bigger laugh here, you know, sweetening the laughter, just as on the most corrupt kind of sitcom. You know, give this a guffaw. Oh, make this laughter last longer. And I thought, my, he's sold out in a big way. He certainly has gone over to the enemy side. So I wrote a negative review of that. And, of course, I heard from him then that he said, boy, you guys really change your tunes, don't you, or something like that. It seems like every time I'm near him, something bad happens. That's why I was so glad when Jim interviewed him at length for the book and got such great stuff out of him. I don't think I could ever have done that interview. I interviewed him briefly with Lorne in the room so that he couldn't hit me. But I still get very nervous around Chevy.
Tom Shales, as a TV critic for The Washington Post, what do you think of Saturday Night Live now?
I love it. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's a cliche, but it reinvents itself all the time, and it has its down years, and then it bounces back up again. And yeah. I've never been one to get hysterical or, you know, to say that the world is ending like Chicken Little when they, you know, when they go through a slump, except for the time when Gene Dumanian took over the show, and I was proud of the lead I wrote for the, because everybody else was writing Saturday Night Dead, but what I wrote was Vile from New York. It's Saturday Night. I did an anagram. But that was the only time I lost all hope for the show, and even then it came back. So I think the amazing self-rejuvenation properties of that show are very encouraging.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you, Tom Shales. Thank you, Jim Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller are the authors of the new book, Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, maker of earth-sensitive hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the war against terrorism with Daniel Benjamin, who served in the Clinton administration as the National Security Council's Director of Counterterrorism. He's the co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.